Okay, so here is my plan. I want to address an Eulerian Lagrangian formulation. The script will become a little larger in a little bit. Eulerian Lagrangian formulation of the equation. Then I will describe the way you can solve the equations for short time with a near identity transformation. Then I will discuss what needs to be under control in order to control blow up. And at any point in the talk, if I feel like people are too bored, I have a little trump card. It's a little a transparency that really has something to do with this meeting. So, right. I actually think that everything else has to do with the meeting, and actually even more that to some degree there started to become clear that Lagrangian descriptions are useful and the statistics of multiparticle Lagrangian descriptions are useful, and we have heard about descriptions of two points moving and their somewhat mean-field theory. We have heard of tetrads moving and their theory, and we have heard of shapes. All these have a common mathematical background, and it's not, let's say, not a new at all. It's the true Euler and the Navier-Stokes equations, and it's just simply maybe writing them in a convenient fashion. So I will go slowly. Let's see, how am I for coins? Coin number one. Okay, no, coin number two there. Okay, so we'll start with setting the notation, familiar things. Okay, so here are the Lagrangian variables at fixed labels. So you label the particle at fixed label. This is a time derivative. And here are the Eulerian counterparts at fixed position. In this talk, the mean flow will be zero. So the fixed position is truly fixed. If you have a constant mean flow, then trivially you can move it. If you don't have a constant mean flow, then it's a problem, and it's non-trivial background flow that you have to take into account, but smooth. So then usual time derivative becomes the usual material derivative. If you have particles, you may have a diffusion added to it, and there will be a diffusion in what I'm going to talk with viscosity. The Lagrangian map that follows a given label in time, the inverse of that, I call it back to label so everybody knows what I'm talking about, is the inverse of the Lagrangian map, and that is an Eulerian object, A of x and t. And the other natural quantities I chose to write here are the deformation tensor, which becomes the inverse of the spatial gradient of A here. So I will use this Q only very briefly, but you remember that it's the inverse of the gradient, A. The particle label derivative, so a straight line here, if you have a straight line, you mark initially some straight lines. Of course, under this transformation, they deform. If you differentiate along the straight line here, then over here, you have to differentiate in a curvy way, and that's denoted by gradient L. So the Lagrangian gradient in Eulerian coordinates is this gradient L. This is the main, let's say, point of view is that you would like to think about flow, but you would like to compute in Eulerian coordinates, which are the lab coordinates. So then all the computations will be here. Now all the quantities, some of them, will have Lagrangian meaning, like this derivative. Okay, so that's essentially the calculation. And I want to argue that on one hand, the reason why this hasn't been done for Navier-Stokes is because it's difficult. And on the other hand, that there is a way of doing it that I think has nice mathematical structure and gives some information. So now I want to describe the basic object. The first basic object, again, this is, you know, straightforward. The first basic object has to do with deformation. So as I said, I have the Eulerian gradient, which is with respect to x, y, and z, the normal coordinates. And I have the Lagrangian gradient computing on the same Eulerian frame in x, y, and z. And of course, they do not commute. So I repeat here the fact that I I consider the derivative with respect to labels, and I consider it in X, pushed back. Okay? So they do not commute. And the reason they don't commute is that if you draw initially a straight line of particles, that doesn't stay a straight line. The commutator, so applying the Lagrangian derivative to the Eulerian minus the Eulerian to the Lagrangian, so this commutator introduces some coefficients which are very natural. They are the most natural thing you can think of. They have to do with how you deform Lagrangian paths. So these coefficients will appear twice or three times in this talk. They are, or many times actually, they are basic coefficients. The way you compute them is by a second derivative. Okay, so I will refer to them as curvature coefficients. They're not a curvature of anything in particular. There's a second derivative, okay? So it's not geometry that I'm interested in, it's PDEs. And I have a reason why I think it's important to do this, and I actually will explain the reason. So the deformation tensor becomes simply the gradient of the back to labels map, Eulerian honest gradient here. Of course, that's the inverse of the deformation tensor. And then these C's, the curvature things, are simply one Eulerian gradient followed by one Lagrangian gradient applied to the position map, to the back to labels map. So it's a very natural object, and as I said, it's a second derivative. This object enters in the next basic, the next group of basic objects, which are the transport basic objects. So you have deformation, and you have, of course, transport. And the transport is done by the material derivative. So the material derivative, which I denote gamma. Excuse me, I don't know if this is acceptable to anybody, but for this talk will be okay. So gamma is the material derivative with a velocity u in Eulerian coordinates. This is the Eulerian derivative. This is the Laplacian. It's going to be written like this only in this slide. So it is the streaming or the material derivative plus diffusion. Okay, with the same coefficient. So you will denote it gamma sub mu and u if you really want to take care of these two parameters, or simply gamma when it's understood is mu and u. And it's a diagonal operator, not diagonal if you do it in Fourier space, of course, because you have the convolution in the u dot grad. It's not a diagonal operator. But it's diagonal that doesn't mix components, as each component by itself. Okay? Doesn't mix components. So if I have an equation, 10 equations, gamma of p equals 0, those are scalar equations that don't talk to each other. Okay? And that's, again, because I'm interested in PDEs, that's the good part. They don't increase mass. The commutator between gamma and Eulerian in the Lagrangian derivative involves the same curvature object. So let's stop for a second and look at this. It's a very natural relationship. It takes a few lines to prove, but it's a very natural relationship because it says, of course, this is a second order differential operator. This is a first order, so the commutator should be second order. But the first order drops out for a very natural reason, and you are left only with something proportional to the viscosity and the curvature coefficients which enter from the lack of commutativity of Lagrangian and Euler. The reason why it's proportional to the viscosity should be clear, because if you turn off the viscosity, you are stating that the ordinary material derivative commutes with the Lagrangian derivative, which is simply saying that time and label derivatives commute. Okay? So the, let's say, the important addition is the nature of this thing as an operator when you do have viscosity. Okay? Involves only this coefficient again. All right? Then there is also, of course, a very natural commutation between gamma and the gradient. This one does not see the viscosity. Instead, it sees the coefficient u because this is the, let's say, the source of the cotangent equation you will see in a second one.
The third one in terms of
Well, you will introduce the curve if you want to express any time you want to introduce. In reality, it's not in terms of the curvature, because it's sort of first order operator, but you can introduce the deformation if you want to pass from here to here. But that introduces the deformation, first order derivatives of the position, if you want to from pass to E to L. Okay? So those are the basic objects. I'm going to keep the last ones on, but they cannot keep more than one. Now let's move on to so this would correspond maybe to kinematics if you wish. These are just basic relations if you do have a velocity field. Let's move on to closer to equations. What? U is not a constant. The background U is zero. If you want to have a non-trivial background, then you have to decompose. Okay, I will address that as sort of like my last point, future things. It's not actually, it's technically a difficulty, but not a fundamental difficulty, because you are going to go as a background flow and add, so it depends on what you're asking, okay? If you take Navier-Stokes in general, you don't need to worry about the background flow. You can always decompose. Navier-Stokes is Navier-Stokes, okay? I'm getting the next transparency will be the equation. So I'm just building up the language so that I have the language. Then I'm going to write down the equations, and I'm going to state a few results that I have about the equations, in particular bounds for the object that I'm going to describe in a second. But the reason why I'm doing it is the same reason that you are doing it, because you actually are doing it, and Grisha is doing it, and Boris is doing it. It's the same thing. So I'm just setting down the notation. It's exactly the same thing. Okay, and at some point it should be clear that I'm talking about the same object. So this transparency has to do with this formula, which is apparently due to Weber and Cauchy from the end of the century before. And it relates instantaneously the Eulerian velocity to the deformation tensor without time integrals. Okay? So the way it's done is that I have a V here. I'm going to explain what that V is. It's a, let's call it for convenience, a virtual velocity. Okay? And I have the deformation tensor transpose, that's the Starnitz transpose, and that gives me U after I apply the projection on divergence free. And here the projection on divergence free in the whole space for periodic case is explicit. If you have boundaries, a big problem. Okay? So if you have boundaries, you really have to think about how you do this. Basically, in that case, you have to expand in eigenfunctions of the Stokes operator and do just simply Fourier coefficients with Stokes operator. In more precisely, you can write your velocity as the sum of the inverse of deformation tensor applied to this V, minus a gradient, and then the divergence free condition fixes the gradient. Now, here is the first observation, which is a formal observation, but I think it might be important, and namely that V is not, of course, uniquely determined if you don't worry about incompressibility. So just ignore for a second the incompressibility. If you add to V a Lagrangian gradient of a scalar, it's the same as adding to U an Eulerian gradient of the same scale. Okay, so this is a little calculation. It's true. And that tells you that I have a gauge freedom. The natural gauge freedom, which is in the Navier-Stokes equation, is understood in terms of the gauge freedom here to add a Lagrangian gradient, which will become a new Eulerian gradient if you open up the parentheses. Okay? No, this is not the... It's related to a pressure, and I can tell you the relation to the actual pressure is the evolution equation of n is related... Gamma of n is p minus u squared over 2. Huh? Right. No, it has. It has, because if you... the next stage, when I have equations, I will have an equation how to update this, And the way to update this is gamma of this, gamma being the streaming thing, is pressure minus U squared over 2. Right? Pressure minus U squared over 2. Okay, so I'll put this up here because this formula is used a lot. And then now on to equations. Sorry for going so slowly, but I think that I tend usually to speak very fast. So I wanted to do this. So now here are the equations and the way they look. One of the good reasons why I'm doing this, there will be a couple of people in the audience from Santa Barbara who understand why I'm doing this. Actually, I'm interested in Navier-Stokes. So these are the usual Navier-Stokes equations. You can add the forces if you need to, but I'm, for the sake of this talk, I'm not gonna. And the equations become two streaming equations. So if you want to think of them, if the viscosity would be zero for the Euler equations, they become active vector equations. Okay. So the first one simply says that you're advecting and diffusing the labels. Okay. And the second one is that you're advecting and diffusing the virtual velocity, and you have a curvature term having to do with the. So this system is equivalent to the Navier-Stokes equation. And this is where it's a little difficult to write Navier-Stokes in Lagrangian form. If you write really in terms of the velocity, you have to invert the Lagrangian map, and it's difficult. This is all done forward, as it were. Active vector. Here it is. Right. So I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. Okay. So this is the constitutive law. This is the U hidden in here. It's got from here. And the observation again is that if I have a passive vector, a scalar, if I have gamma phi equals zero, and V solves this equation, then V plus gamma gradient, he solves the equation also. Okay? And here in this little box, you have the actual tensorial structure. T has three indices, and it's contracted with the gradient in this way. Okay. So these are the equations. Now, what can we do with these equations? First of all, I want to make an aside and mention that these equations explain very naturally where did I put them? No, this is what I want, yeah. I want this one, and I... Yeah. Take any one of them. Okay. So, the observation is the following. This is a Navier-Stokes system, okay? If you make the product, the object that is the product between the gradient and the virtual velocity, it solves a simple equation, okay? Remember, actually, this is not simpler than Navier-Stokes. Navier-Stokes itself can be written in a rather simple fashion if I use this gamma notation, you know? So it solves this equation with no pressure, okay? W and V are not divergence free in general, okay? And that's an advantage. That's where the gauge freedom comes from. W and V are not a divergence free. Only after you project, you get back your divergence free velocity. So this equation is the cotangent equation. I call it a cotangent equation because if you have any scalar, passive scalar, then its Eulerian gradient solves the cotangent equation, okay? So, but this W is not a passive scalar. It's just this very active product of the gradient and V. And it solves this equation. And if you look at this equation as a system, this has the structure of the Kamasa-Holm alpha model. Okay, so the Kamasa-Holm alpha model is really a modeling of the Navier-Stokes equation in which instead of doing this, which is the true Navier-Stokes equation for the W, for the product of this and this, you replace the operation of projection by a smoothing operator. Okay? So, for instance, a projection is a finite, replacing it with a finite expression in the Lorentz projection would give you another kind of Kamasa-Hall. Okay. So that was an aside. And now I'm getting to a few results. So the first result that I want to state, or the first bunch of results that I want to state, are about L, which is this object here. So here, now I'm going to pause a little bit because these are, now so far this was formalism, now they're bound. Okay? If you take your back to labels, so this is the label where the Lagrangian started. So if you start on the Lagrangian particle and you allow t time, you end up at x. So we are going back, okay, as appropriate for fields, as Grisha was telling, and you join these two by a straight line, which is called L, as in the shape things that these guys are doing. Then there are bounds for L and its gradient. Bounds that are using the Navier-Stokes equation, and from the Navier-Stokes equations, they use the only thing we really know about the Navier-Stokes equation, which are the kinetic energy balance and the kinetic energy bounds, but used in a elaborate way. So here are the bounds. First of all, a very natural and pleasant bound that L, which starts from zero, grows like URMS. We have not. Huh? It's a bound. It's a bound, right? It's a bound. It's a bound. Okay. It happens to be true, right? Okay. Yeah. Huh? This is easy, right? Let me tell you what's unpleasant. Okay. So this is LRMS. However, if you want to take the maximum of L, then you don't have any more smallness for small time a priori. Okay? So here are things that, you know, it depends on how much you believe that ignorance is important. Ignorance is important. We don't know how to extract information. And this is the reason why I think it's important to do Navier-Stokes correctly, is that it's a big, I actually want to emphasize this in this community, it's a big, big scandal. We all talk about long-time behavior of Navier-Stokes solutions and Euler solutions. We don't know how to control those things a priori. And my trump card, that little slide that I'm going to do when I feel that everybody is bored, will say that you actually, it's inescapable. It's inescapable. One has to confront this problem. And ignorance is important. The fact that we don't know that this is small for small times in maximum norm may be something that's important. Something is hidden in that. Anyway, the bound that there is a bound, so it's bounded but not necessarily small. And the bound is in terms of URMS and the outer scale and viscosity. So it's a horrible bound. Okay? And of course you would like to throw this away and say it's only square root Newton. Okay? Another bound is about the time average of the gradients of L. Now, when we talk about gradients of L, realize that these are gradients of your, so these are like things that you would like to do in fusing these points, these shapes together. So in RMS, these gradients are bounded, and actually, for small times, they are small. Okay? And finally, there are bounds also for the Laplacian, which is the second derivative in space of your L, RMS, and again, there are terms in terms of the URMS. These are all the bounds, rather, this is the highest derivative one can really bound without assumption. All this is true without any assumption. If you want to do further stuff, you have to input an assumption. Okay? Now, I'll keep this here. This is, I have few results, and there, this is one set of results. One. The other set of results will seem to you, if possible, even more boring. So let me talk to you a little bit about that, see how it goes. So the constitutive equation can be written as identity x plus, you know, this is the gradient of a, okay, plus the gradient of x applied to the virtual velocity, okay? So if nu equals zero, which is an important case because especially for very large scale things, you would like to argue that nu is zero is important, then v is simply the initial or the reference velocity composed with your a. So you got rid of the v equation. Because gamma v equals zero means simply this. Okay? And then you want to control the evolution for short time. So the statement is here is that you can control the evolution for a short time in terms of a little more than one derivative of the velocity, which is a modest in CL. So, it, which is a modest requirement. And the so the statement is that there exists a unique solution for a short time, and this, the solution is well behaved with respect to this norm. The second statement is that if the if blow up will to happen, you will have to have the gradient of this Lagrangian maximum norm diverge, the second part. So if this does not diverge, this is again the fusing of shapes. If this does not diverge, then there is no singularity in the Euler equation. It's absolutely the analog. It is actually an easy consequence of Dilke-Automat. Okay? But it is expressed in terms of the Lagrangian. So it's, if you wish, the meaning of Dilke-Automat in this context. Okay? I nevertheless want to explain a little bit about, not the proof, but the background of this. Because it is a method of construction of solutions. So the proof that there is, hey Gustavo, I didn't put you here. It's Günther Wollibner, Ebin Martin. This I went to 70s, okay? And then there are newer things. Gustavo Pons is here, who actually contributed to the newer things regarding the existence of solutions in the Euler equation. But it's a very classical thing going to the 20s, okay? So this has a little fewer derivatives in it, but the main point is a control in terms of C1 alpha and actually C0 alpha of L. So here is how you do it. You try to update your L, okay? And the way you solve this simply means that you are keeping an old velocity. You take an old velocity, an old L, and make a new, you have an old velocity and you upstream the labels with the old velocity, and you get yourself a new labels, and then you get yourself a new velocity by the constitutive equation and repeat, okay? I'm gonna write it down again, because the main point is that you do it for a short time, you control until the gradients didn't grow too much, and then reset. When you reset, you have a new start point, and I think that that's actually, again, something very related to what people do. Now let me repeat that here. It will look a little, It will look a little complicated. It's almost time for me to take out my magic slide that will wake up people. Okay, but let me repeat it. I'll repeat it with language, okay? So you have the L space, which are little curves, bits of curves, okay? It's a field depending on x. The time zero starts at zero, and they are nice and continuous with a one derivative in the bit. You consider the space of path. In the space of path, you have a little segment in which the gradients are controlled by quantity. This is non-dimensional, intrinsically non-dimensional, and I want to emphasize the difference between intrinsically non-dimensional and non-dimensional because I change some units and divide by something. This is non-dimensional by itself. You control this for a short time, then you have a map that takes you from a bunch of little paths to new paths. And the map is done by solving a PDE in which the old path enters as a coefficient, and it gives you a new path. And then the statements are that this map, of course, keeps these nice short paths together, And the most important thing that I want to emphasize is that it's stable in a very low norm. So these things, in order to control them, remember the equation involves the gradients. Okay? So you need to know the gradients are finite. But you control low norms with no gradients. Okay, so this is an important thing, because it says that as long as nothing bad happens to my solution, I can control displacements, I can displace in a very rough manner, and I don't go far. Okay, and this means that there is a chance to do statistical solutions in this space. Okay, I'll come back to this. Time out? Time? What? The Trump transparency, my gosh. Okay, let me try to go there. But I need the... Okay, let me go there. I want to make one more thing, okay? Just one more, please. Okay, one more thing is for the Navier-Stokes what controls. In the previous one, the time step was set for the Euler by the magnitude of the gradient of L. In Navier-Stokes, you have to do the same thing. D drift is no longer composed all the time. This is both good and bad. It's good because you have to solve the PDE with fixed grids. You don't have to, actually, you fix this. You fix your Eulerian grids and solve the PDE to find your V. But it drifts away. It's not no longer composition. And the controlling thing is the L3 norm of C. This is, again, in three dimensions. This is, again, an intrinsically non-dimensional object. You don't divide by something to C is a curvature, it's a 1 over length, and you raise it to the third power, integrate over volume. Huh? It will be square. Okay? So, and then you have a bound in terms of this object of the L infinity norm, or any LP norm of V0. It doesn't more than double. Okay? So when is muon important? When the curvature is small. Small compared to one, not to this guy. Okay, now let's change gears, wake up people. Okay, what does this have to do with the price of rice in China? Looking for it, I'm looking for it, okay? Here. One of the main, and I think it's a fundamental question that... The curvature is important because if you didn't have the curvature, you wouldn't couple the gradients to the equation. You'd have streaming. You wouldn't couple vectors together. You'd have just streaming of this thing, and it would be automatically bounded. Okay, so that's for technical reasons. And the real reason is because the viscosity becomes important and helps you, perhaps, only when things turn on a very small scale, which is the Lagrangian object that is described. All right. I think the $50 question in the whole thing here is whether or not singularities and statistics have anything to do with each other. At all, right? And here's a little theorem that's very easy, and it's food for thought. Very easy to prove. It's a consequence of something that is known. And here it is. Let's read it together, and then I can stop, and we can talk about it. Suppose you have statistics. You have some statistics. They don't need to be time independent. So I didn't put T here, but it could be that they're evolving in time. And suppose there is a moment of some order, larger or equal than phi, so that this thing gives you an answer, just gives you an answer. So when you say you have statistics, that means that you have a measure that you are measuring with. Then with respect to that measure, almost all solutions are smooth. No singularity. So you cannot talk about the 17th moment and singularities in the same breath. Huh? Here, Wi-Fi. No, it's 3D, this. 5 is like this. If I have a deterministic solution, I can put a condition from any t larger than 3. Okay, on deterministic solutions. It's a mixed space and time integral. In space raised to the p power, in time raised to 2 over p minus 3 power. So if p is infinity, then the L infinity norm squared controls the flow. If p is 3, you have parabolas has to be continuous. Now this exponent, in order to do Hölder's inequality, I want to pass the average through and discover this object inside. So then this exponent has to be less or equal than 1 so that Pitamar won't complain to me that the time and space integrals shouldn't, the order matters. So if this is smaller than 1, which gives you p equals 5, magically, the one that nobody starts trusting, then you can pass the average inside and you say that the average of this thing is less than the inside of the average, right? You put the average inside, you get the assumption that this is finite, so you get a bound. And then by classical things, if the integral of something with respect to a measure is finite, well, that thing is almost everywhere finite. And therefore, almost all solutions have that thing finite, and that thing guarantees the smoothness. So that's all there is to it. And it means that we are confronted with the issue of regularity and cutoffs in Navier-Stokes, even if we don't want to think about it. Now, what? Which last? The one that we are confronted with? We are confronted with the problem of singularities in Navier-Stokes equations because this statement says, of course, that if you want to state that this thing scales with some length scale and you want a regular answer, the length scale must have to do with the inner scale, okay, and not the outer scale. So then if you don't want that and say, no, that's really insignificant, that really doesn't matter, then the whole range between the inner cutoff and the one that you think is really the cutoff here, that needs to be understood and explained. Why is it that it doesn't matter? Well, if I really don't care, because if I have one of the components being infinite and undefined, then you can infer situations. So only if at least one of them doesn't exist can you have singularities. Well, if it diverges in the average, then you have the usual things with, you know, like the same thing. If constancy of epsilon doesn't mean that there are singularities in Navier-Stokes. Constancy of epsilon means that something actually is large. But
you also presented
Yes. L is it's a length. The gradient of that length. There is a relationship, formal relationship, between the gradients of velocity and the gradients of L. So if you write down that equation, the state that says that u is the projection of gradient A times v, then if v is really the Euler situation in which v is just the initial velocity composed with A, take the gradient of that, you get a relationship between the gradient of velocity and the gradient of A, instantaneous in time. Right, sir. Right. The vorticity is the square of the gradient of L, not the first power. The vertex? No, no, no. The time instantaneously. Instantaneous. It's the square, not the first power.
The thing where